Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Imperfect Buddha Podcast, the podcast that dares to think differently, with your host, Matthew O'Connell, featuring interviews, long-form conversations, and think pieces, exploring theory and practice within a 21st century practicing life. Visit imperfectbuddha.com for more, or keep listening to new episodes at the New Books Network. You're listening to the latest think piece, entitled, I Refuse to Change. I returned to England recently and spent a quality afternoon speaking to the old co-host of the Imperfect Buddha podcast, my buddy Stuart Baldwin. We had one of our usual conversations, the sort I only really have with him, which are generally humorous, profound, silly, filled with critique of prevalent currents in wider society, and of course, a deep discussions of Buddhism. I mentioned that I was thinking about writing a few pieces at the Imperfect Buddha website on topics related to the coaching work I do. We also discuss why so many give up on practice when the going gets tough. A key theme we kept coming back to was resistance, and its many subtle faces. And as it also comes up a lot in coaching, I thought it might be an appropriate topic for the first post. Although I may not produce a whole series of these, I do think this one is important. It can be understood initially as a message to myself and to past and present clients, and to those who may be oblivious to its role in subverting practice and blocking meaningful change to one's life. It is ubiquitous, I'm afraid, often cunning and very subtle. To start, I want to share an anecdote or two. The first concerns my personal experience of having been involved in a great variety of spiritual activities and practices since I was very young. One thing I came to notice over the years, even when I was young, was that people, no matter the traditional practice, would reach a certain point in which pleasure and comfort would switch over to discomfort, as genuine disruption to the norms of their lives began to manifest. Things started to get serious, and the person would start to think about leaving. Now, there are many good reasons for ditching a tradition, of course, but there are also many ways of taking the signals of necessary change as a signal to resist or run. This resistance is often aided by the shifting values of wider society. So whereas once it may have been the need for spirituality to feed one's individuality and license to do as they please, now it is often about life being rather too much, of the practice not quite being right, or the need for practice to fit conservative or progressive ideological aims. Buddhism is forever subject to presentism. In those earlier days, interesting discourse would often ensue. The more intelligent the person, the better the strategies. Justification, reinterpretation, and straight-out denial were commonplace. A yarn would be spun, excusing the behavior, or ushering away what might have been a critical moment, an opportunity. With time, I came to understand that these were various manifestations of psychological resistance to change. Over the years, I came to see how successful resistance can be at stopping people from carrying out change or seeing into the nature of their own patterns of deception and delusion. Perhaps this is obvious to some of you, but when you're fully in it, it's blinding for most. The stories continue to be interesting, however, because, well, we all have a tendency to shield ourselves from what we don't wish to see, and also because the humanity behind the story is itself worthy of tolerance, patience, and kindness. Some benefit from being told to stop bullshitting themselves, but most need a little more kindness and a little more encouragement just to get over the hump. Of course, there is positive resistance too, and there's plenty that oscillates in between the good and the bad. But who determines when it is one or the other, or leaning farther in one direction or the other? If it's you, then you may have a small problem on your hands. Freud informs us that it is hard for the ego to direct its attention to perceptions and ideas which it has up till now made a rule of avoiding, or to acknowledge as belonging to itself impulses that are the complete opposite of those which it knows as its own. The second observation I've made over these years concerns teachability. Within many of the Buddhist traditions, there are rich stories of teachers and disciples struggling to find each other. The emphasis is generally placed on the difficulty of finding a good teacher, a realized teacher, a truly enlightened, authentic, lineage-wow teacher. Though perhaps a little hyperbolic, the story of Naropa and his teacher Tilopa is a rather excellent example. But, every so often, one comes across a story that illustrates the opposite of how difficult it can be for a teacher to find a decent student, someone teachable, someone capable of learning, someone willing to meet resistance as a sign things are getting interesting, for example. The fact is that teachers and students need each other, and this applies as much to the world of meditation and Buddhism as it does to standard pedagogical environments, including schools and universities. Two fundamentals thus for folks approaching any kind of change work, whether short-term or a lifetime's dedication to the practicing life, concern these two facets, relating to resistance and becoming more teachable. The ability to navigate resistance really is key to one's ability to move beyond habitual patterns. And for this to be possible, one must be teachable or capable of becoming so. And I'm not only talking here about the specific and explicit role of a teacher-student relationship. Events, circumstances, life, wider culture and society are, of course, all, in a sense, teaching us things. As is Mother Nature, as is change within the natural environment. Another point concerns recognizing that making the path explicitly or only about well-being, happiness, or the end of anxiety is to turn it into yet another project of spiritual materialism, and therefore to engage in a practice of self-improvement or self-defense. Now, who am I to judge? If that's what you're after, great, go for it. If you are genuinely attracted to the radical side of Buddhist ideas of liberation from suffering and its ethical commitment to a world of suffering and a duty to respond to it, then inevitably you must be willing to come up against your own resistance, whether that be intellectual, emotional, physical, behavioral, etc. I have a nose for resistance. I see it in myself. I see it in my teaching work. And I see it in the coaching work. Key themes include the reluctance to accept appropriate degrees of responsibility, the unwillingness to make decisions when they must be made, and in the habit of giving up all too easily, especially when change one seeks actually begins to emerge. There are those who disappear from opportunities to learn because it's easier to do so than be honest with yourself or with someone who may hold you accountable. I see it in those who remain in dysfunctional group and teacher-student dynamics because it's what they know and because it's better to be comfortable with the devil you know and take a risk. I see it in Buddhist circles when folks grasp at the certainties of their beliefs, or the familiarity of their practice, or refuse an opportunity for insight that may destabilize the comfort or role they've grown to like just a little bit too much. I see it in the tendency to avoid challenges to sacred truths or the taboos of a given group. As humans, we have this choice. We can say no. We can say no to change. Even doing so, knowing that the change is what we desperately need and will make us a better person or take us towards an insight our lives are screaming out for. For many years, I thought this was not possible. I genuinely and naively believed that all you needed was to present the challenge differently to such folk, find the right resources, rephrase it in digestible terms, and yes, everybody would then jump at the chance to change, to grow, to become more of who they could be. But this is wrong. I was wrong. I was holding on to a well-meaning utopian ideal that was incompatible with flawed, imperfect humans like us. Sometimes it turns out that people say no and no again, even when it robs them of a better life, and even when appearances dictate that they shouldn't be doing so, or, in the worst case scenario, that it leads to their demise. Resistance is human after all. Our species resists as a natural function of its own survival. The physical organism resists, and our psychology does so as a consequence. We resist as collectives too. We share in collective patterns of resistance to change and hold on to shared ideas and identities. And you know what? And even when we accept change, our embrace of it is often highly selective. Buddhist organizations are as much caught up in the self-preservation instinct as other complex organizations, and not just the religious ones. Much of the accommodation side of contemporary Western Buddhism can be understood as a shared practice of avoiding the trail of a resistance to deeper levels of change, challenge, and insight. Some items of resistance. Here are some of the common forms of resistance I have seen over the last decades. With some phrasing you may be familiar with, it's all rather crude, I'm afraid, and not particularly scientific. I'm not suggesting that what follows are wholly bad, only ever negative, or denying that their function, in the right context, may be fighting for or against something that needs resisting, such as exploitation, coercion, manipulation, dodgy gurus, and so on. Or that they might even be an expression of self-respect or an assertion of confidence that should be obvious to any thinking listener. But I've said it anyway. The question really is one of utilizing these as strategies to resist or avoid necessary change. Let's take a look. Being stuck in what you already know. Typical phrases that follow from this one are, well, this is just how it is. I've always done it this way. It's always. It's never. Or as the annoying Mandalorian spout in the Disney series, this is the way. Well, maybe it isn't. Being stuck in comfort. I'm fine as I am. I like being this way. It feels good just to... Yeah, I just do that bit of practice because it makes me feel good about myself. Actually, practice should make me feel good. A variation on staying comfortable. Resistance to uncomfortable or unfamiliar feelings, states, thoughts, identity. That's too much. No thank you. Fuck this. Oh, I can never do that. That's not for me. I don't need to do that. That's not important. No one does that anymore. Resistance as an assertion of selfhood. This is who I am. I know myself. I've always been like this. I'm an X, and therefore I definitely... Resistance as assertion of self-authority. I know what I need to do. I don't need advice from anybody. No one knows me better than I do. I know myself too well. Ah, that can't be true. Excuse me. I do find these amusing. However sad and dark they may be, they are also an amazingly creative, ongoing feature of human psychology. Anyway, next one. Don't worry, there are just a few more. Resistance is rebellion against external authority. I'm going to do what I want to do. Fuck him, fuck her, fuck it. I believe in free... fill the gap. DIY practice all the way, baby. Who needs a teacher? Fucking gurus. Tradition sucks. Resistance as intellectual cynicism. Yeah, I don't believe in that. You what? I don't think you know better than I do. In fact, no one does. I know for a fact that ex-philosopher said, and therefore, I have a PhD, don't you know? The truth is... Okay, apologies, some of you listening to that. I might have touched a nerve. But intellectual cynicism is perhaps one of my favourites. I can't help but think that deep down, it's a form of cowardice. But hey, who knows? Two more. Resistance as dismissal, the cynic's final gesture. This is all bullshit. Resistance to what's unknown, usually seen in giving up too easily. I could never, I will never, absolutely not, absolutely no, I can't possibly do that. Those are just a few. I don't want to burden you with too many, but maybe one or two resonate. Of course, I'm sure you see them in other people, not in yourself. Change isn't always positive, of course, or necessarily explicitly goal-orientated. Much change is simply demanded of us by the circumstances of our existence, and our capacity to move with change is directly related to the degree of psychological suffering we can potentially experience and tolerate. There are many all too familiar with the difference between two types of practice. The first is performative, overly prescriptive, and it asks us to shape ourselves into new, self-alienating forms. It is the enactment of a false self which seeks to mimic and act out the idea of practice as a sort of performance, as meeting the expectations of others. It rarely goes anywhere and rarely forces us to touch the depths of human confusion and suffering and therefore resistance. And if it does, there's often retreat. The second kind of practice is constructed through the meeting point between practices, ideas, theory, and ideals, and our experiences accumulated through a life lived imperfectly. The former often justifies resistance through encoded dharmic norms. The other returns us to our humanity and forces us to own up to it. The opposite of the resistant subject is not a wholly non-resistant person, for such a being has likely never existed, and if it did, it probably didn't survive for very long. Rather, resistance is a form of powerful communication that governs our ability to change or not, to be teachable or not. Resistance is par for the course in a lived life and needs to be navigated rather than wished away or hidden behind or within an ideological story. It is rare, if not impossible, that anyone has successfully navigated resistance consistently throughout their life without input from fellow humans. We are too limited to do it on our own, which I find quite beautiful and reassuring. This observation is also a fine middle finger to neoliberalism and the excesses of individualism. We do actually need each other, and if we're lucky enough, we may meet enough people capable of pointing to our resistance and recognizing it for what it actually is. If we're even luckier, we may actually hear what they're saying, experience the new, unexpected flavor of disruption as this happens. Take stock and open to the possibility of change. This is a rare treasure of the sort that Tibetan Buddhism speaks of. To finish up this last section, so what do we do? Well, some of you will have a few ideas about that already. But as a kind of general suggestion, a starting point, you could simply go back to the list of different forms of resistance, apply each to yourself to find out more about your own dysfunctional habits, and also question why you might use such language. What is it protecting you from? What is it allowing you to avoid? Honesty, of course, is a fundamental feature when facing resistance. One useful form of practice is to seek out what it is that is resisted. This is an approach that has been experimented with by different spiritual paths and psychological trends. You might ask yourself a question along the lines of, where do I find comfort within each of these forms of resistance? How do they play out in my relationship to folks and events and practices in my own life? Some of it's going to be there. It's going to be there for all of us. To bring it back to coaching, I have had people that have come to me for help, who seemed utterly unprepared to undertake the sort of work that would be necessary to deal with the issues they brought to the relationship, and yet they surprised me. Unexpected strengths were discovered. Unexpected resources were found, and the desire to know themselves and the world beyond what was familiar persisted enough for them to make real and lasting change. Others instead have seemed all too ready to go forwards, and naturally talented and intelligent, and yet have fallen at the first hurdle, or found the most wonderful excuses to stop once the going got tough. The truth is that these folks are the majority. Most people give up. It's too difficult. No, I mean it. Really, it is. It's too difficult for most people to engage in long-term, sustained change, especially the sort that disrupts the continuity of self. This is one reason why so few Buddhists live up to the challenges of what Buddhism presents in its highest ideals. It's obvious once you think about it. And just in case you're one of those well-meaning, nice folks out there, this is not a criticism of them. It's just an acknowledgement and recognition that perhaps we shouldn't kid ourselves so much about what's going on. We are such complex beings, and the fallacy of instant gratification promised by the culture of immediacy that we are all immersed in has made it even more difficult for people to maintain the sort of psychological stamina and bravery that leads to ongoing and worthwhile breakthroughs. Being difficult, though, is okay. It's not actually a sign that one shouldn't move forwards. It's not a sign that it cannot be done. It is just the case that it is difficult to make meaningful change to your psychological emotional self. It is difficult to establish new patterns of behavior that significantly disrupt your sense of who you are and maintain them long enough to break from the strands of our past. But this is part of what the deep depths of Buddhist practice, teachings, and ideals points to. It reminds us that suffering is deeply entrenched in our incapacity to do just that. Here's a truism. It's perfectly possible to change, and it can be done. In a Buddhist context, this can be coupled with some of the core insights of Buddhism that highlight possible forms of resistance. Death. I may start and never finish, so why make the effort? Interdependence. Others, or the world, or my job, or the environment may not allow me to change to the degree or in the manner that I wish to change. Emptiness. I may discover that what I'm looking for doesn't actually exist or is meaningless once I put in all the effort. Or the outcomes may be different from what I expect to find. Therefore, why bother? In fact, all of these are great reasons for not bothering, right? Excuses come in all shapes and sizes. We should probably start a collection of them collectively and expose them to the light of day. Don't get me wrong. Please, don't get me wrong. I am not judging my fellow humans that stumble and fall. I have great sympathy for what it is that stops a person from pursuing the change they have been looking for. I get it. I really do. it can be really tough to face. Not the easy problems and challenges which are usually the most visible, but the ones that are hiding in the nooks and crannies of our inner psychological landscape and denial, that pop up and say boo when we least expect it. Final thought, the first step I like to take when people get close to turning back from the edge, and it's one I try to do myself, is to invite them to come to know their own mechanisms of resistance, to meet them, experience them as an item of practice. Some people are teachable enough to get this, others are not. Sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not. Maybe it's a matter of time, sometimes, however, that a time appears to be a whole lifetime, and they're dead before it starts. Welcome to the human condition. This is me, Matthew O'Connell, and sponsor of the Imperfect Buddha podcast. That's right, it's my podcast, and I'm sponsoring it. Is that even possible? Well, who cares? I'm doing it. And this is really a reminder that I coach, mentor, and teach folks the weird and wonderful ways of the practicing life. Drawing on person-centered counseling, life coaching, critical dialogue, and years of teaching and group facilitation, I coach and mentor folks looking for an alternative to the current market of self-help, spirituality, and religion. Much of what I have specialized in touches on themes that have been explored in the podcast. So for those new to this podcast and this kind of approach to coaching, let me fill you in a little bit. I use post-traditional tools and tools taken from the world of non-philosophy and non-Buddhism and my own experimentations with both. Most of the clients that come to me through this podcast are current or ex-Buddhists, ex-spiritual types, and those cautiously approaching practice with a view to keep their intelligence and critical faculties intact. If you are an intellectual hiding your desire for something along the lines of a spiritual practice, yes, the scary quotes are out there, don't be shy, come on out of the closet and be proud. We'll find a way to make it work that you don't need to be ashamed of. Seriously, I mean it. I work with traditional coaching and counseling methods too, as well as meditation. And for the more adventurous folks, I can offer shamanic tools, well, they're really neo-shamanic tools, and concepts, and something akin to a practice rooted in a reconfiguration of our relationship with the natural world, minus the romanticism. I offer a sliding scale, so whatever your economic status, if you're genuinely interested in upping your game, money should not be an obstacle. Wherever you find yourself in your life right now, if you wish to refine your relationship with practice and take a leap into a deeper relationship with the practicing life, do get in touch. The first session is non-committal and won't cost you a dime, a euro, a cent, or a penny. We'll decide together whether it's going to be a potentially good working relationship, and if so, you can commit to a cycle of practice sessions. I currently do most of those online through Skype or Zoom, although if you happen to be in Italy or somewhere near the border, you might even come down for a session in person. You'll find all you need in a contact form at imperfectbuddha.com, or you can get in touch through imperfectbuddha@outlook.com.